Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to our afternoon session. I hope you enjoyed your lunch and you are somewhat refreshed and ready to go for another kind of information-packed afternoon. This just immediately after lunch slot is always a dangerous one, so unfortunately David's drawn the short straw, but to hopefully waken us up and enthuse us again, before we hear David speak, the band are going to come up and we're going to sing a song which is relatively new to, certainly new to me, it might not be new to you. It's called Lift High the Name of Jesus, and again it reflects really the reason why we are here and the mission of the church. So we'll stand as the band introduce, and then after that David's going to come up and speak to us.
Good afternoon, welcome back, and we're in for another fast-paced session. I'm going to try and just adjust the volume of material that I've got for this afternoon and hopefully not have to rush quite so much as we did earlier on. Can science explain everything? Well, having a scientific explanation for something is, of course, a very credible, strong position to be in. And lots of people have used a scientific explanation to sell all sorts of ideas to the world. I want to introduce this one to you. This is the Quadro Tracker. You may have come across this before. Actually, the company that manufactured these from West Virginia made a couple of thousand of them and managed to sell at least 900 of them into schools in North America. They were basically a kind of piece of plastic with a Radio Shack antenna, a bit like this, attached to it. And the idea was it was a bit like a dowsing rod. And this particular version is a British version, actually, that they sold to governments in Afghanistan and Iraq. You may have heard about it in the news. It was basically a device for detecting explosives. And the Iraqi government spent about £52 million buying these things. It's a complete junk. They did nothing like they claimed to do. that the dowsing rod, or the quadro tracker, as was manufactured and sold to school administrators in North America, was designed for detecting drugs. They could detect all sorts of things, golf balls, drugs, explosives. This particular one was sold to these schools so they could go down the corridor and detect drugs in a student's locker. And you might think, that sounds a bit far-fetched. Indeed it was. They sold them for $900 at the time, sold a lot of them, made a lot of money, ended up going to jail. Did they detect drugs in students' lockers? Well, the answer is yes. If you open enough lockers, you'll find some. Whether it was a dowsing rod, of course, was another matter. So if something has a scientific basis, a scientific sounding name, somehow it gives it a measure of credibility. And we live in a society which you've heard already is based on, likes to think of itself at least as based on fact. And if that fact is scientific fact, then it has street cred and people are likely to pay attention. My question to you is this: why do you believe what you believe? You can believe anything you like. You are entitled to believe anything you like. I reckon that most of us believe what we believe because it makes sense of the world in which we live. But many people believe things that are absolutely not true. If you're going to believe anything, folks, at least make sure that what you believe is true. And I've committed the cardinal sin of forgetting to start the timer, so I'll start it now. What we're interested in today is giving you a sense of confidence in the position that you take. How do you show that what you believe is true? And people, of course, bring all sorts of values to the table, whether they're theists or deists or naturalists or nihilists or whatever else they might be. They might be involved in some kind of postmodern thinking or mysticism or whatever. And all these philosophies will come and color the way people position themselves. But for most of us in this society, I reckon it would be fair to say that we believe what we believe, and we show that what we believe is true because we can present some evidence and some reasoning behind it. And this is where science, I reckon, scores. It is an endeavor to provide an understanding of ultimate reality. And people will define science, and it's fiendishly difficult actually to define science in a complete way because there's so many different disciplines and so on. But one of the issues about science which keeps raising its head again and again was exemplified by this fellow who's actually a rheumatologist. He's a medic. He became the government's chief scientific officer. He's now moved on from that role and is doing something else. But at the time he was interviewed by the Radio 4 Today program, he was interviewed on the issue of what was known as the reproducibility crisis. One of the things about observational science is this: if you demonstrate something by observation or experiment, one of the key things that makes that accountable is if some other person or group can take the approach that you've taken and demonstrate the same findings. And one of the issues in modern science is that that is a very difficult bar to reach. In fact, something like, I think, Nature, which is one of the most cited, most respected journals, probably in the world, carried an article not long ago showing that some 53 articles on oncology, attempts were made to reproduce the findings, draw the same conclusions, and of the 53, I think only 6 could be reproduced. And it calls into question the reliability of the scientific evidence if that is what is achieved in the best of research institutes. Malcolm McLeod's a professor of neuroscience in Edinburgh, and he was involved in this, and in fact his report was the focus of this particular interview with Mark Walport. And Mark Walport, and I picked this out just as a little quotation, he said this, and this would be widely believed: science is fundamentally about discovering the truth about things. It is the most powerful method we have about finding out about the natural world. The Nature article, the editorial that accompanied the issue of the reproducibility crisis, called that into question and said, actually, because of all sorts of other values, you follow the money, and that will direct the kind of conclusions that are drawn from some of these scientific experiments. In the competitive crucible of modern science, various perverse incentives, and it might be money, it might be fame, it might be the pressure to publish and so on, they'll undermine the scientific method, leading to a literature littered with unreliable findings. That's in nature. And so there's clearly a bit of a question mark. Can science explain everything? Can it explain the most important things in life? This is what I sometimes call the golfer's question, because it came up on the sixth fairway of Cardross Golf Club, and I was marching there with another three guys, and we got into the sorts of things that nobody can answer. There are two things that nobody knows the answer to. There they are. Where have we come from? And what are we here for? Well, can science explain the answer to the golfer's question? Let me go back to the Today program. You're going to think I'm a bit of a Radio 4 freak. Nevertheless, you'll probably remember back in 2009, some of you will remember at least, the time when Alan Johnson was the Home Secretary, Labour Home Secretary in the Blair government. And there was a huge to-do at that time because the individual who was the Chief Scientific Advisor, the Chairman of the Committee on the Misuse of Drugs, was an interesting character called David Nutt, a great name for a psychopharmacologist, that's what he was. Professor Nutt was the chairman of that particular committee, and he fell out with the government because he published a paper that was evidence-based, but it seemed to run counter to government policy on drugs. And so here he was, the advisor, but yet he seemed to have a foot in the other camp, and he lost his job, and there was a great to-do about it. And the introducer wasn't John Humphreys, in fact, at the time, in November 2009, it was Justin Webb. He said, "Science, the very word, conjures up in the modern mind a sense of trustworthiness and respect for rational truth." Then the following day, they had Robert Winston on, the fertility researcher, popularizer of science, of course, another medic. And he said something very interesting. I was careful to get this quotation right. He said, "Science is not about certainty. Science is about probability. Not about absolutes. We scientists," he said, "give the impression that science is about the truth. It's not. It's about what is most likely." So it's really important to get an understanding of what science actually can achieve in terms of its explanatory power. You'll have reductionists like this who believe that everything can be brought down and ultimately explained on the basis of physics and chemistry and natural law. This is Peter Atkins. He's an author of chemical textbooks. He's an Oxford Don. He says there's no reason to suppose that science cannot deal with every aspect of existence. Well, I want you to think about that question just for a minute, and we're going to come back to that when we explore this particular territory. Here's one of my, I suppose, intellectual heroes. This is Peter Medawar. Peter Medawar's now dead, but he was the individual behind a lot of the understanding of transplant immunology. He worked with a plastic surgeon in Glasgow, as it happened, when he was working on skin grafting and the second set phenomenon, so-called. And he is the individual who's credited, actually got a Nobel Prize for his work on immunology. And he noticed this. He was a very acute writer and perceiver of truth here. And he picked this out. He said, "The existence of a limit to science is made clear by its inability to answer childlike elementary questions, the golfer's questions, questions having to do with first and last things, questions like, how did everything begin? What are we here for? What's the point of living?" These are the questions of ultimate reality. And he says, science doesn't get there. It's limited. It doesn't answer everything. Here is arguably one of the greatest thinkers and philosophers, mathematicians, as you can see, of the 17th century, Leibniz. And he asked a great question, of course, which remains to be answered. Why is there something rather than nothing? Well, you can lay awake at night and worry about that. But here is one possible way of looking at it. And this is sometimes dressed up as the cosmological argument. Some of you will be familiar with this. And it runs like this. Whatever begins to exist has a cause for its existence. Since we know that the universe began to exist, what's the conclusion? By pure deductive reasoning, the conclusion is the universe has a cause. So right away, you've got a philosophical argument that points to a non-material, incredibly powerful force with foresight that is responsible for bringing the material universe into existence. So there's no sense in which the universe can create itself. And I want to come back to that because that is some of the thinking that's currently out there. This is Lawrence Krauss, you can see on the left, who's a to the mind of some people, a somewhat objectionable, rather outspoken astrophysicist from the Arizona State University. In fact, I think he's just terminated his contract this last month. He was involved in some kind of scandal about 6 months ago, and he decided to end his career. But he wrote this book, which is essentially an evidence-free zone, but it's a book which claims that the universe could create itself from nothing, a universe from nothing. Now, his definition of nothing is not what you and I would think of as nothing, no thing. His definition of nothing involves some kind of quantum field, some kind of bubbling vacuum of energy or whatever. And he's got no empirical evidence to base the kind of unsustainable arguments that he advances in this book, but it's got amazing credibility. Just give me 1 second to let you see an example of the sort of stuff that he peddles in this book. For surely, he says, and this is in the right at the beginning of the book, nothing is every bit as physical as something, especially if it's to be defined as the absence of something. I'm tempted to say, give me a break. That is clearly nonsense. And yet this is the kind of stuff that people like Krauss peddle. Here's another very impressive scientist, died just over a year ago, as you know, Stephen Hawking, and held in high regard. He wrote an interesting book, not his final book, at least probably the final book that he had a definite first hand in, with Mladenov, The Grand Design. And this is an interesting book too, because he makes various statements and questions in this book. He asks these questions, for example. These are the ultimate questions that concern us. Can science find the answer to these questions? How can we understand the world in which we find ourselves? How does the universe behave? What's the nature of reality? These are the golfer's questions. Why do we exist? Why this particular set of natural laws and not some other? Why is there something? There's Leibniz. Why is there something rather than nothing? And you've got to ask, well, are these questions for science? There's only one, which is a scientific question there. Can you see it? There it is. How does the universe behave? That's a scientific question. The rest of the questions are philosophical questions. But he says this, and this is a direct quote from The Grand Design. Traditionally, these are questions for philosophy, but philosophy, he says, is dead. It's not kept up with modern developments in science, particularly, well, he would say that, physics, of course. As a result, scientists have become the bearers of the torch of discovery in our quest for knowledge. Now, I hope your dowsing rods, your antennae are twitching already, because they ought to be. There's a deep-seated incoherence in that statement. Because what Hawking is saying, he's making a claim, which is a philosophical claim, but philosophy's dead. So essentially, if you like, self-referentially, it doesn't make sense. It self-contradicts, it's logically fallacious. It's incoherent to make that sort of claim. And just to give you an example of the sorts of things he says, and I'll just give you two examples of this. John Lennox has talked about this in his book in a bit more detail. Because there's a law such as gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there's something rather than nothing, why the universe exists. Not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper. So, folks, gravity did it. But hang on a second. Gravity ain't nothing. Gravity needs mass in order to describe anything. And actually, more fundamentally, for the universe to create itself, you've probably noticed the incoherence here, it has already to be in existence, or it can't do any creating. So there's a deep-seated philosophical incoherence there. No wonder John Lennox said, nonsense remains nonsense, even when spoken by world-famous scientists. So I hope you realize that not everything you accept from a scientific point of view is genuinely acceptable. We spoke a bit about life sciences earlier on. I want to give you this quotation, and I apologize. I don't like putting a lot of text on slides, but in this particular case, I think it's important that you get the thrust of this particular quotation. Because here is an honest scientist. He says, we take the side of science. This actually resonates so much with what Mark had to say earlier on about the secular worldview. He says, we take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failure to fulfill many of the extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for unsubstantiated just-so stories. a universe from nothing might be a good example. Because he says we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. And here's the kicker. Look at this. He says it's not that the methods and institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenal world, but on the contrary, that we are forced by our a priori, our upfront adherence to material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce material explanations. It's got to be material or it doesn't count. No matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated, he says, moreover, that materialism is an absolute. Why? Because we can't allow a divine foot in the door. At least he's come down and declared his colours. No divine foot. We don't want anything to do with a divine foot, and so we're prepared to accept any kind of nonsense that people are prepared to peddle. Even Bertrand Russell, who in his time was highly respected as a philosopher, mathematician, logician, he wrote this. And if you're really paying attention, you'll realize that there's a deep-seated incoherence in this as well. Whatever knowledge is attainable must be attained by scientific methods. Science can do it. What science cannot discover, mankind cannot know. Is that a scientific claim? No. So you can't know it. It's self-referentially incoherent, folks. So he might have been a brilliant logician, but his logic deserted him when he wrote that sentence. There are loads of things that science can't explain. Atkins was wrong. Russell was wrong. The honest scientists will accept that there are a whole series of things. You can look at them. Mathematical and logical truth, for example. Science depends on maths and logic. So to imagine that they are scientifically proven would be to argue in a circle, and that's a logical fallacy. Take metaphysical truth, the golfer's question. Science doesn't get close to that. The why questions, why are we here? What's the purpose in life? Is there any meaning to life? What about statements of fairness or value or ethics or duties? Science can't really investigate that. That's not empirically observable. And the beauty, like the good, appreciation of music or art or culture in some of its various forms, that's not accessible to science either. In fact, you could claim that just about everything that's of real, ultimate, lasting value to us as humans is not scientifically provable in any acceptable way. And strangely enough, science itself can't be scientifically sustained. What does science need? It needs to have a set of natural laws. It needs to have a system of maths and logic. It needs to have a predictable universe. But just because the past has been like the past in the past doesn't mean to say that the past is going to be like the past in the future. You cannot assume that that's going to be the case. Otherwise, again, you're trying to hold something, prove something which can't be proved. You're arguing in a circle once again. I wanted briefly, and I've got probably time to do this, to touch on the question of another area that science has real difficulty with and is struggling with in neuroscience these days, and that's the question of consciousness. You ever thought about the brain and the mind? Just briefly think about that for a second. Is your brain and mind the same thing? Well, let's have a look at some of the mental states that we might recognize. And here's a whole series of them: sensation, desire, intellect, perception, will, and so on. Now, which of these are brain states and which are states of mind? Well, let me help you sort that out. I'll just try and put them into a couple of columns and see if we can make some sense of this. Here we go. So they should sort themselves. There we go. So on the left, you've got brain states. And on the right, you've got states of mind. And they're fundamentally different. And when you think about it, the brain states, whether it's sensation or perception or memory or whatever, they have a link to the external physical world. In other words, if I had an apple here, and actually brought an apple and left it in the car, I wanted to show you this lovely red apple that I picked up this morning. And you would see the red color, and you would appreciate the red color, and you would recognize that it's a particular wavelength of light, and the reaction is in your retina, and it's transmitted to your brain, and you have that sensation of redness. In fact, perception goes a little bit further than that. But beyond that, if you think about the redness of the apple, what constitutes the appeal or the beauty that they might have. You can see a ring in my finger, represents the fact that I'm married. That's fine. You can see the ring. That's physically instantiated. But what you don't see and can't pick up and can't explain is the emotion of love and connection that might be behind that in the relationship that I have with my wife. If I hear my name across a crowded room, I can detect the sound waves and the particular pattern of sound waves. But that does nothing to get to the emotional connection between the individuals or even the discussion that they may have about reason in the natural world. So you see, there are states of mind that go beyond simple brain states. These on the right-hand side have no obvious connection. Where do thoughts come from? Where do ideas come from? There may be no connection whatsoever with the natural world. And so it's not a surprise that neuroscientists have defined this, as did David Chalmers, who's one of the leading lights in this particular area of research, as the easy problem of consciousness, and that's the stuff on the left, essentially, and the hard problem. Why even is there some sense of self-awareness? Why have I got this movie running in my head and I have this awareness of conscious experience, so-called qualia, that people sometimes talk about? And people have worried about this and been concerned about it for generations. Here's Descartes, and he reckoned that there was a distinction between brain and mind, between the immaterial component of life and between the physical components. I think, therefore, I am. And you get scientists making claims like this, you see. Actually, this is the only comment I'll make in this particular talk about anything of an evolutionary nature, but I was particularly drawn to this quote because I think this is utter nonsense. The idea that human minds are the product of evolution is not atheistic theology. It's unassailable fact. Show me. Show me your evidence. Where's the empirical science? It does not exist. Ladies and gentlemen, is that science? Propaganda. It's part of the secular agenda. I hate to say that, but that is the truth of the matter, and we need to wake up to that. People like C.S. Lewis, and actually even non-theists, people like J.B.S. Haldane, came out with quotations like this. He said, and the extended quote basically says, that if minds are wholly dependent on brains, so they're dependent on the basic biochemistry of the brain and the physiology of the brain, he said, I can't understand how the thought of this mind should have any more significance than the sound of wind in the trees. In other words, if it can all be reduced to basic physics and chemistry, why is it any different in quality from these other natural phenomena that have no particular significance to us? Here is a book which you might want to consider looking at if you're needing a headache. This is a good place to begin. Thomas Nagel is an atheist philosopher, and he's written a book called Mind and Cosmos. It addresses this issue of whether or not things can be reduced to a basic material explanation. Can science explain everything? Well, what you probably can't see in that slide is the subtext of his book, which runs like this: why the materialist neo-Darwinian conception of nature is almost certainly false. And his argument kind of runs a little bit like this. He says he's actually quite a difficult guy to read because his syntax and terminology I find to be a bit of a struggle, and I've got to reread some of the things, and you probably have to reread at least the second paragraph here. He said, for a long time I've found the material account of how we and our fellow organisms came to exist hard to believe. Well, join the club. Including the standard version of how the evolutionary process works, he says, what's lacking to my knowledge is a credible argument that the story has a non-negligible probability of being true. In other words, the materialism account just doesn't quite work somehow. You can't bring things down, whether it's consciousness, and that's a starting point. So if you've got consciousness and you can't explain that, and that's an essential component of life, then you don't really have an adequate explanation of life. And if you don't have that, then nor can you really claim an adequate explanation for the origin of chemistry, or for that matter, for basic physical laws. And so he ends up with the conclusion that the reductionist agenda, that science can explain everything, just does not work. So as we bring this into land, let me come back to our questions of ultimate causation. Where have we come from? What are we here for? What do we say to the golfer as we get towards the green? Well, it comes down to a worldview issue, ultimately. And I think there are basically two ways of looking at this. There are basically the materialist view and the theistic view. Either there's a God involved in the process, or that the whole thing is basic naturalism, What's the difference? Ultimate reality for the materialist is matter and energy. Ultimate reality for the theist is God. For the materialist, matter and energy give rise to the notion of God. For the theist, God gives rise to matter and energy. So you see, they're fundamentally different. One is bottom-up, the other is top-down. They are completely, diametrically opposed to one another. Can science do it? Can science actually explain these things? These are the things that we need to explain. How close do we get? Well, philosophically, we can't get everything from nothing. Chemically, we can't get life from non-life. Logically, we can't get fine-tuning from randomness. Intellectually, we can't get information from chaos, and we don't quite know how to begin to explore the issues of consciousness and rationality, which we value so highly, and we certainly can't get close to these from a scientific point of view. Why do you believe what you believe? Because it makes sense of the world. What is your evidence and reason? And as I conclude, I'm reminded of that amazing incident where we heard about Paul earlier on in the New Testament, and how he was taken ultimately and arrested in Jerusalem. He was held in custody. His nephew got wind of this and tipped him off that there was a plot to kill him. He went to the authorities. He was shipped off to Caesarea. He appeared before Felix. And before Felix, he had, I think, more than one opportunity to explain a defense for the sort of faith position that he held, why he believed what he believed, why it made sense to him. And eventually, after 2 years of imprisonment, Felix's term of office came to an end. Festus replaced him. And there was this incident recorded in Acts 26, and you can read about it, where a very telling thing takes place, I think, where he has this opportunity of explaining his story, his experience of life, to Festus, Porcius Festus, who was the new governor of the area, together with the king, Agrippa, and Bernice. They were there. And Paul started to explain about his life and about what he believed and about why he believed it. And he got to the bit about the resurrection of the Lord Jesus. And Festus stood up and interrupted him and said, "Paul, you are insane. This is insane talk." And Paul's response was quite interesting, because what he said in response to that was this: "O most excellent Festus," notice the respect, "I'm not insane. What I'm saying is true and reasonable." That, folks, for me is the Christian position. It's backed up by evidence, it's sustainable, it's true, it's reasonable, it makes sense of the world, and it has a good, solid, credible intellectual base. That is why I think you can be confident Christians. It's time for us to get off the back foot and engage with our culture and begin to make the important difference that can be made in our society. Thank you very much.
Couple of minutes, just as Mark sets up for the next talk and switches over the technology, so you can stand and stretch. And now is probably a good time to be thinking of those questions that you might like to ask towards the end of the day. As I said, there is cards downstairs where you can write down your question. There will be mics available as well, so that you can ask your question in person. But you've got a couple of minutes to chat to your neighbour and maybe think about some of the things that have grabbed your attention thus far, and some of the questions you might want to ask.
Thanks, David. That last session was hugely stimulating and very, very helpful. And you kind of think, how do you follow that? I'm going to talk about this subject: can I disagree without being disagreeable? And the whole question of dialogue. What prevents dialogue and what might facilitate dialogue? Let me just begin to unpack that, and we'll see where we go with this over the next few minutes. Christian faith has always spread by dialogue. It's always spread by people talking to each other. For conversion to take place, let's just think about it logically, it requires a conversation between, before I was a believer, somebody and me, when we disagreed. And then once we had disagreed, We then had some discussion, dialogue. In my case, almost violent discussion, actually, and dialogue. And then there needs to be some sort of change. You can leave it unresolved, or if there's going to be resolution, someone needs to change. Now, I just want us to hold that thought for a second or two, that dialogue between two human persons requires disagreement and discussion. And one of the things that we're going to think a little bit about during this session is the fact that we're living in a cultural moment where dialogue is increasingly difficult to have, not least because disagreement is increasingly suppressed. It's not allowed. And it's very difficult to have meaningful disagreement. So what I want to talk about is some of the things that stop us from actually being able to have dialogue and disagreement. Because if there's no disagreement, there's no real dialogue. And if there's no dialogue, then there's no real evangelism. And I think that we would, most of us who are here today, consider that that would be a problem and a challenge. However, there's also ways of dialoguing with our friends, with non-believers, that are either consistent or inconsistent with following a crucified Lord and being conformed to his image. So, I mentioned in the talk earlier on, things like playing the victim or aggressive demanding of rights, judgment and condemnation of others. These tend to reinforce certain cultural norms instead of subverting them. Christians, as I said earlier, might end up winning some arguments, but what do we lose, or what might we lose in the process? Over all of this talk, I would just love that simple phrase that I put out earlier on, can we do Jesus' work in non-Jesus ways? To ask that same question yet again. Let me start off by just a very, very brief consideration of some of the biblical material. These are just a 5-minute Google search. You can look at these for yourself. They're fairly horrendous. But how we treat people is one of the fundamental questions that we should be asking. The fundamental ethical questions that we should be asking. The Church of Jesus Christ is called into existence in order to bless the nations, to be, as Paul says in Ephesians, a dwelling place for God by the Spirit, where his presence and his character is located and demonstrated to the world. And the way we treat people, the way we treat each other and then others outside, is going to reflect the character of that God. Therefore, there are some ways that we might engage in dialogue and discussion that are going to be inconsistent with that. Let me just draw on 2 or 3 biblical passages really quickly. I'm skimming very lightly over these. Luke 6, in one of Jesus' spats with the Pharisees, he says this, love your enemies, do good, and lend, expecting nothing in return. Your reward will be great, and you will be sons of the Most High. What do sons of the Most High look like? They are those who imitate the Most High, who reflect his character. For he, Jesus says, revealing the character of God to us, he is kind to the ungrateful and the evil. Be merciful, even as your Father is merciful. Now, maybe you just glaze over and you think, oh, it's all familiar territory. But just think about this text for a second or two. One of the things that this really challenges is the tendency for many of us as Christians, it's to draw on Andy's phrase earlier on, of being crunchy, to be quick to condemnation and judgment, as though that's somehow what constitutes a good witness. Whereas in fact, it seems to me that Jesus is saying, no, you have to be kind and merciful. That is your posture towards a world, even a world that at times will hate you. It's a posture of kindness and mercy because that's what your Father is like. And you're called to reflect his character. Luke 9, we see something rather similar, actually. It's in the chapter that has at its center Jesus' call to discipleship, deny self, take up cross, and follow, sandwiched between the sending of the 12 and then the sending of the 72. And towards the end of that chapter, there are three little vignettes, three little worked case studies, if you like, of what it looks like to deny self, take up cross, and follow. We have we have personal competition, who's the best. We have group competition. Please stop that group over there who are being successful casting out demons. Jesus, it's not fair. Stop them from doing it. And Jesus says no. And then thirdly, There's a Samaritan village that rejects Jesus, will not accept him and welcome him. James and John, of course, have just been on the mountain of Transfiguration with Moses and Elijah. James and John basically say, go on, Lord, let us call down fire from heaven. That would be great, wouldn't it? Just to call down. They're rejecting you. We feel humiliated and ashamed. Let's have some fire from heaven. Let's show them who's really boss, right? Jesus turned and rebuked them. And it's worth letting that really sink in. It seems to me that here in this text, Jesus is actually rebuking something that has given us, evangelicals, a really bad name. And that is the speed with which we rush to call down fire from heaven upon those who reject Jesus and reject us. The speed with which we will want to call down fire from heaven on those who disagree or stand against us. Those that we see to be the enemies in our culture. And I put this text here because I think it's of vital importance because of some of the other things I'm going to say. We don't engage in a culture war in order to call fire down from heaven upon those who've got it wrong. But rather we are called to deny self, take up cross and follow. A posture of kindness and mercy, and indeed self-sacrificial giving and love towards a world that often will hate us. Does this mean that we therefore should not distinguish between what is right and wrong and what is true and false? Of course not. Not at all. We can distinguish between what's right and wrong and true and false, and at the same time adopt this posture of kindness and mercy. Kindness is a vastly, vastly underrated quality. And it is, after all, one of the fruit of the Spirit. There's a call here to the kind of way that we then engage with the world around us. 1 Peter 2, I'll not read it out in detail, but essentially what Peter's saying is, look, if you're going to suffer, suffer genuinely for the gospel. Don't suffer for being idiots. And I'm sure you're familiar with this, and I've come across it. It's a remarkably self-reinforcing narrative that you come across in some people. I came across it I'm not going to tell you where I came across it. It would be risking giving away things. But it's a narrative that says, if I'm experiencing opposition, it's because I'm being faithful to the gospel. And therefore, the more opposition I'm getting, the more faithful I'm being. And therefore, the opposition reinforces the fact that I'm being faithful. Right? Except, what if you're getting opposition just because you're being an idiot? You're just being stupid and you're treating people badly. And many of us do that. So we just need to be careful of this warning and take it really very seriously. We do live, though, in a cultural moment where there is a demand for affirmation, not just tolerance. Because tolerance, of course, by definition means I don't agree with what you've just said, but I'm not going to hate you for it. That's tolerance, right? But that's not what we have in our culture right now. Our culture right now says, no, you're not allowed to actually disagree with it. The demand is that you must affirm everything. And if you don't affirm it, you're a bigot or you hate this person. If you don't agree that this conception of marriage is okay, then you are therefore homophobic, for example. It's a changed definition. I want us just to think just for 2 seconds about the logic of this, though, because it is fascinating. This is actually a downgraded definition of love. If we say, you can only love me if you agree with everything that I am and say and think and do and all my opinions, we're saying we need to be the same before we can have any love. But what's Christ-like love look like? Christ-like love looks like those who can say, I disagree. I disagree with a lot of what I do, never mind what you do. But not only do I refuse to hate you for it, but I take Jesus' call to love you and to sacrifice myself for you, seriously. That's a far, far greater love. And it's a love that our society is in the business of not just excluding, but almost making illegal. Do you see how our definitions then become really incredibly important? Let me think just a few, I think there's about 8 points here, but on separate slides, not all on one slide. obstacles to dialogue. Let's think about the kind of things that stop us from having meaningful dialogue with our non-believing friends around about us. One is obvious: friendships. If we don't have actual friendships with real people, it's unlikely that we're going to get into many conversations with people. And those friendships may take a long time. I'll illustrate this towards the end, just to finish with. I have known a bunch of fellow rugby coaches for a decade now. Some of the wives have come to faith, but these men, boy, it's ongoing friendship and prayer, lots of. But if we are overcome with fear, or if we're just too busy doing Christian stuff, this is going to be more difficult for us. Other obstacles to dialogue. There have been historic misrepresentations, both of the church. If you say church to your average person walking down Union Street, what's their opinion of it? How might we seek to correct a bad opinion? Maybe there's things that we might have to apologize for in the way that the church has misrepresented Jesus Christ and his good news. The danger, and this is something that we're always engaging with, every conversation we have, is of people rejecting the gospel for what it isn't, rather than engaging with it for what it is. A third obstacle is confidence in the truth. There's a big issue here, really, about the way that we think of Christian nurture and discipleship. If we have an environment of Christian nurture and discipleship where people don't really get to ask their questions, then those people are going to be constantly nervous that just around the corner they're going to meet that person who's going to ask them the question that they can't answer. They're going to have a lack of confidence. In other words, for real Christian nurture that's going to give people confidence to engage with the world around them, there needs to be an environment where people can ask all of their questions. However hard those questions might be, however unsettling they might be for you as their small group leader, for example, or their pastor, however much that might get you off track in your Bible study agenda that you've got to try and get through tonight, if people can't ask their questions, they're not going to be confident in engaging with other people's questions. We have to have that kind of environment. So a model of church that is just about delivering the right opinions to people and then discourages questioning is actually going to be characterized by growing cognitive dissonance, the suppression of fears and doubts. It's also going to lead people to withdraw from conversation and dialogue, and then a witness that's just characterized by shouting our own slogans a bit louder than others. It's a challenge to take discipleship really seriously here. Now, this is a bit more of a complex point, this one. Bear with me. Identity, will to power, and loss of identity. There's been a move over the last few years which has resulted in a situation where disagreement and criticism is increasingly being suppressed. Let me give you a quick run through some recent, I suppose, philosophical history. I shouldn't do this with Max in the room, who's a professional philosopher. It's a very dangerous thing that I'm now doing. But really, from about the Enlightenment onwards, we have a change of freedom, of definition of the idea of freedom. What is freedom? We see freedom changing from being the freedom to pursue, develop character in service of one's fellow men and women, to an idea of freedom being a freedom from constraint. Freedom from external constriction, constraint, or law. The idea then that we should have no external constraint, and that's what freedom means, then elevates the idea of the expressed individual, that I should be free to express the good that's in me. I wonder if you're hearing that, or you're hearing echoes of that in lots of contemporary entertainment particularly. The idea that I have an authentic self which must be freed from the constraint of stupid parents, laws, authorities, and so on, in order that I can be this good person that I'm meant to be. It's Disney, right? I've enjoyed sort of saying rather provocatively to people that actually Disney's going to do your kids more harm than porn will. The idea you can sit your children down in front of something that's neutral is just absurd. It's an idea's delivery system. It's delivering a whole view of reality, a world view. Actually, it's delivering often a view that we might characterize as expressive individualism. The authentic me needs to be free from all of these external constraints. And any external constraints that try to stop me from expressing me are wicked things. Those are the evils in the world that must be eliminated. I wonder if you're hearing echoes of that in our contemporary culture. In that sort of environment, then, identity is chosen. It's not conferred. It's unstable rather than stable. In this context, then, any challenge to a behavior or an opinion is not just a questioning of a behavior or an opinion. It's an assault on someone's identity. And that's why we've seen this shift towards people talking about speech as violence. Hate speech. If you disagree with me, it's because you're, whatever I am, phobic. Because my identity is something that's then chosen as an expressed individual. And if you disagree with that, you're attacking my very identity. Not just what I believe, you're attacking my identity. Does that make sense? It's very profoundly difficult to think, how do we then engage with this? Contrary opinions, externally imposed law, are a harm to be resisted. Even with violence, we've seen US campus demonstrations recently. We've seen the deplatforming of dangerous speakers in the UK. We've seen Peter Tatchell, the gay rights activist. We've seen Germaine Greer, one of the best known feminists in the world, both deplatformed for, I think, transphobic views in each case. Again, just to draw on David's language, the problem with this position, of course, is intellectually incoherent. The demand that no one else should be able to say something that might harm me is in fact a demand that an external authority should stop that person from saying what they want to me. Do you see the inconsistency of this? At the same time as I demand that no external authority should stop me from expressing me. So who gets to decide who gets shut up? Who decides in this environment who gets shut up? All of this shuts down meaningful dialogue, and it causes increasing insecurity and anxiety. And the challenge, of course, is to show a different way. I'm just going to skip this next one, actually, rather than go into it in detail, because I see the time and I fear the wrath of Solas. But it's worth reading a book recently published by a guy called Jonathan Haidt, I don't know how you pronounce his name in the States, called The Coddling of the American Mind, and it applies very closely here too, about some of the features of life that make people increasingly look for safe space where they're not going to be challenged or not threatened in any way, and shows how actually this is based on a whole bunch of cognitive distortions that lead to people being more and more psychologically unwell. But it also shuts down, of course, any conversation. The freedom rights, freedom to self-express, increasingly needs a growingly powerful government or state that will police self-expression and police those who are not allowed to say the things that stop me from self-expressing. That also, I believe, is something that should alarm us. Who decides whose freedom should be privileged? Who gets to decide that? And again, we should be alarmed by that. Is it just the person with the loudest voice and the best PR campaign? How should Christians engage with that? On those terms? Perhaps not. Echo chamber of online life. People only ever hear opinions they already agree with. And then we see the return of honor shame with Twitter mobs, one slip, ruthless punishment. No one being able to admit wrong. Behavior, vocabulary, opinion, and orthodoxy markers set up. And then a failure to observe those orthodoxy markers, guaranteeing attack. We've seen it in various different celebrities who've slipped, said something wrong, and then had to issue these embarrassing apologies that they do, that they've said something that, of course, is not true to their true self, they would say. How do we respond to this? A Christian responds to those first three: friendships, misrepresentation of them by the church. Well, repent, listen, and love people should be obvious and shouldn't need said, but of course. Confidence in the truth. Taking discipleship seriously, discipleship that really equips real people to live in this real world at this moment of time, to fight the battles now, not the battles of yesteryear, but the battles now. To fail to do that is like First World War generals sending their troops over the top of the trenches. Is that what we're doing in our churches? Sometimes it is. We've got to really think very, very seriously indeed about this. How do we respond to some of these cultural factors? This really is a huge intellectual task. And I think I talked a little about this earlier on, but it's certainly not about creating brains on sticks. It's about seeing people formed in the image of Christ, seeing their intellects formed to think rigorously and outthink and outlive a culture. It needs people to take discipleship and mission really seriously. It requires all that we have, all of our resources and all of our effort. And as I said earlier, we are late to the game in the church in Scotland. For example, there is currently no Christian think tank in Scotland. Why not? Presumably, we just don't think this is very important. But we live in a culture which has got some of the most powerful ideas delivery systems ever invented by man. And if we don't teach people to engage with those ideas, to know what's true and false, and to realize it's the water we're swimming in, it's the air that we're breathing, if we don't help people to see that, we are just sending them over the top to face the machine guns. That's kind of what it's like. I've said all these points. I'm just going to read this quote very quickly and then I'll close with a brief story. I've always been struck by this quote. If you'll forgive me, it's a split infinitive. But apart from that, it's very good. To honestly and sympathetically deal with the best case that any form of unbelief can make and then show the desperate need that still remains and how it can only be met by the true God and his redeeming Son. This is the excellent way. Do you see that? Don't set up straw men and knock them down. That's too easy. Find the best possible case and engage with it and show why Jesus is still needed. I heard Eileen Stalker give this talk about 15, 16 years ago now. She talked about this job of engaging with the world as being building bridges so the gospel can be heard for what it is and not rejected for what it isn't. This has been part of my own story very deeply and has impacted my life hugely in my engagement with my father. My father died about 3 years ago and crashed his own plane into the sea, unfortunately. But for 30 years, I'd fought for a relationship with him. I came from a non-believing family, and when I first came to faith, there was real hostility to that faith. And I made every mistake it's possible to make as a young believer. I was harsh. I was condemnatory. I was judgmental of my non-believing family. I did nothing to commend the gospel. In fact, I blew up the bridges rather than built them. A turning point in our relationship was when I was about 29 and I was convicted that I needed to go and apologize to him, even though he had never apologized to me for anything, to apologize to him for the way I judged him and been condemnatory towards him. I judged him not least for he was a very successful businessman and the way that he used finances and spent lots of money on stuff. I began to realize, in fact, that that was not just an expression of materialism, but a desire in this man for beauty and for perfection and for goodness and for truth. And to build a bridge that said, "Dad, I'm sorry I've judged you," for him not to get that, but it to mark a real change in our relationship. And then to build bridges that allowed us to begin to talk about God, to talk about truth, to engage together. That was in 1998. And from that point onwards, we actually had a relationship where we could talk about those things. And we went from a situation where in 1992, he'd threatened to cut me off from the family were I ever to leave medicine and do Christian ministry, to a point where he was not just supportive, but said, "I want to support you because I believe in what you do." We fast forward to just 5 months before his death, and we're in France on a holiday together. And he drew me aside because of a comment my mum had made. And he repeated to me something he'd said 29 years previously. A really awful thing. He'd regretted. And I knew he'd regretted it, but he'd never told me. Typical Scottish father, right? He drew me aside and said, "What a terrible, terrible thing to say. I shall bear the shame of that to my grave." I said, "Dad, I really appreciate you saying that. As far as I'm concerned, it was forgiven a long, long time ago. And the thing about forgiveness and the thing about God's forgiveness is that he bears that shame, and you don't have to bear that shame. And then half an hour after that conversation, it was a lovely conversation. Half an hour after that conversation, we had this photo taken, this goofy smile on his face. And then he died 5 days after a conversation where I was able to bless him and he was able to receive it. And it's a story of a 30-year journey from outright hostility to the gospel to dying actually at peace with God. 30 years, though. A long, long time. This wasn't hit-and-run evangelism. But one of the points I really want you to grasp in that story is that for my dad to even be willing to listen required me to change. It required me to repent. It required me to stop judging him, stop condemning him, and adopt a posture of love and mercy so that he could see the same love and mercy in a heavenly Father. So that's the call. Simply put, love people well. That's the key to Christian public ethical engagement. It's the key to our personal lives. And all I can say in closing is, dear brothers and sisters, let's follow our Master in this calling. Let's labor with all that we are, all that we have, to present this good news, to present good news of Jesus faithfully and relevantly, never accepting that we have to sacrifice either faithfulness or relevance along the way. And let's do it in the expectant prayer that as a result many will see, and many will fear, and many will put their trust in the Lord. Let it be so, Lord. Amen.